Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the webinar on India Law on Prevention of Sexual Harassment at the Workplace Made Effective. This session is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates. The speaker in the conference are Mr. Vikram Shroff, Head HR Law, Nishit Desai Associates, Mr. Ajay Singh Solanki, Senior Associate HR Law, Nishit Desai Associate. As a reminder, all participants' lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's session. If you should need assistance during this conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star and then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference has been recorded. I would now like to hand over the conference over to Mr. Vikram Shroff, Head HR Law, Nishit Desai Associate. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you. Good evening to everyone. Thank you for joining us for this important session on prevention of sexual harassment at the workplace. The reason we are doing the session today is largely in view of the fact that the Act, which although was enacted in April 2013, got notified and was made effective as of last week. And accordingly, as of now, this is a new law that has come into effect. There was quite a bit of confusion when the law was enacted in April 2013 in relation to whether the law has been made effective or whether there will be a separate notification in relation to the effective date. And now, with a notification being introduced last week, it has clarified that the law has been made effective as of December 9th, 2013. And accordingly, all organizations, all establishments in India will need to comply with the provisions of the new law on prevention of sexual harassment at the workplace. So we will go through the salient features of this particular law and also focus a bit more on the rules that were also introduced last week along with the effective date of the law. And then we will open up the floor for questions. So spending a couple of minutes on the history on the Indian law on sexual harassment, we obviously have enamel slide 4, just for your reference. There are provisions in relation to anti-harassment under the Constitution of India. There are also provisions in relation to anti-harassment in the Indian Penal Code. But in the year 1997, what is considered as a landmark ruling of the Supreme Court of India in the case of Vishakha versus the state of Rajasthan, the Supreme Court directed all organizations to come out with certain guidelines and policies in relation to prevention of sexual harassment against female employees at the workplace, and directed the government to start working on a new law. It took the government almost 16 years to come up with this law, and better late than never. It was obviously a few incidents that happened over the span of last 1 year that kind of triggered the implementation of this new law in quick time. But it's good that we finally have a codified law on sexual harassment of female employees at the workplace. I'll just spend a minute on the Vishakha judgment that I just mentioned, where the Supreme Court acknowledged that sexual harassment is a human rights violation. And it is also a violation of the constitutionally guaranteed fundamental rights that were enshrined under the Constitution. The Supreme Court, while passing the judgment, made the employer responsible to prohibit and prevent acts of sexual harassment at the workplace and to redress and resolve grievances pertaining to sexual harassment. What the Supreme Court said was, until a codified law is in place, the guideline will be equivalent to the law and is to be followed by all organizations. Unfortunately, not many organizations were really aware that they were required to follow certain guidelines, because while the Supreme Court judgment was in place, because of the absence of a codified law, it kind of went unnoticed in several instances. Until recently, we've had cases where companies failed to form a committee, which was a requirement as per the Supreme Court guidelines, to deal with the cases of sexual harassment against female employees. So we saw the introduction of the new law in April 2013, the law called the Sexual Harassment of Women at Workplace Prevention, Prohibition and Redressal Act 2013. As I said earlier, it was notified on April 22, 2013, but was made effective on December 9, 2013. The Act has several definitions that are of critical nature, including the definition of employee. It's a fairly wide definition to cover, you know, regular, temporary, ad hoc employees, and it also covers employees who are directly employed by the employer or through a agent or a contractor. So it would also include contract labor that has been engaged by the principal employer, which contract labor is working at the workplace. The remuneration part is not really necessary. There aren't really any sort of thresholds in terms of, you know, monetary limits, or there aren't really any sort of exceptions in terms of, you know, employees who are at a managerial or supervisory position. You know, all employees, this law would apply to all employees irrespective of whether they are probationers, apprentice, trainees, contract workers, ad hoc employees, etc. And aggrieved women is, again, another definition under the new law, which basically says that it's a woman of any age, employed or otherwise, and alleges to have been sexually harassed. And it's really an aggrieved woman who has a right under the new law to take up against her employer any matter involving, you know, sexual harassment. The new law also has a definition of employer, just like almost all other labor laws have a definition of employer. And the employer is basically defined to mean a person discharging contractual obligations with respect to the employees, and persons who are kind of responsible for formulation of policies. The thresholds for employers are, for an employer is obviously management, supervision and control, which is some of the critical aspects to determine the employer-employee relationship. And that's what's also indicated in this new law. One of the, possibly the most important definition in this new law is the definition of workplace. The reason being that, you know, the law seeks to prohibit sexual harassment happening at the workplace. The workplace is very widely defined to cover not just the four walls of the organization, but also, for example, a dwelling house in case of a domestic employee, also a temporary restroom that may have been provided by the employer. The workplace also includes society, trust, NGOs, hospitals, nursing homes. It also covers government-owned or controlled establishments. It also covers sports institutes and stadiums. And all of this is, you know, with the background of the fact that, cases in relation to sexual harassment happened at, several different places. And, a lot of times, the question was whether was it the employer who was responsible for that particular case in terms of protecting the female employees, or was it outside the scope of the workplace and therefore, you know, the employer should not really be responsible. So a lot of those questions are put at rest with a very wide and detailed definition of a workplace. And even situations where, any place visited by the employee, either arising out of or during the course of the employment, would be included within the definition of workplace. So, for example, if an act of sexual harassment happens in an employer provided transportation service, that would be covered within this new law because that has been included within the definition of workplace. So to that extent, obviously it's not just, you know, when you're framing your policies in relation to prevention of sexual harassment, you're not limiting it to the physical office premises, but you're also looking at it beyond that to, cover the wide definition of workplace in the Act. I'd also like to mention the fact that it's really how you draft your policy and at what extent of protection you want to, you know, provide in your policy. But irrespective of that, you know, because of the wide definition of workplace, any incident that would happen within the workplace would be covered and the employee would end up being responsible. there were cases in recent times where harassment happened in a cab service provided by the employer, especially in case of female employees who work in night shifts. And even those under this definition would be covered within the definition of workplace. So the law goes on to define what is sexual harassment. It's basically a demand or request for sexual favors, making sexually colored remarks, physical contact and advances, showing pornography, unwelcome physical, verbal or non-verbal conduct of sexual nature. So it goes on to provide, what constitutes sexual harassment. This is something that we typically also advise our clients in terms of drafting their policies to kind of provide sort of examples of what would be included within the definition of sexual harassment. So the employees are aware that these kind of situations could end up being included or could be considered as sexual harassment, for which, a particular process needs to be followed. In fact, the law goes on to provide in a bit of detail the circumstances that would be considered as sexual harassment. So, for example, any implied or explicit promise of preferential treatment in employment or a threat of detrimental treatment in employment could be circumstances that could eventually be considered sexual harassment. So the law is obviously well drafted to that extent, as it has envisaged these situations and tried to clarify to the extent possible, what kind of situations may be considered sexual harassment. Because at times it is, employees are really unclear as to whether they were sexually harassed or physically harassed, or was it some other form of harassment. And thanks to the clarity provided under this law, the employees, female employees, would be guided by, the kind of circumstances that have been indicated herein that could be considered as sexual harassment. Consistent with the guidelines that the Supreme Court had issued in relation, under the Vishakha guidelines in relation to, how to go about investigating an allegation of sexual harassment, the new law envisages a requirement to form an internal complaints committee for those establishments that employ at least 10 employees. To that extent, the law has not really deviated from what was originally proposed by the Supreme Court, and it continues with the same level of requirement of forming a committee, which committee will investigate into the allegation of sexual harassment at the workplace and provide its views and recommendations to the employer, based on which the employer will take appropriate disciplinary action. The employer is required to appoint the ICC by a written order. Another requirement is that the ICC needs to have at least half of its members as females. That's again a requirement under the law, because the law is really protecting female employees. The law does not really envisage sexual harassment of male employees. The ICC is also responsible to prepare and submit an annual report to the employer and to the district officer. So to that extent, there are quite a few obligations that have been imposed upon by the ICC, upon the ICC, and the employer will have to regularly train the ICC to ensure that, the members in the ICC are well aware of, their obligations and how to go about in case there are allegations of sexual harassment. The new law envisages the ICC to be a four-member committee, which includes a presiding officer. A presiding officer is a senior level female employee from the workplace, and if the workplace does not, or that office does not have a senior level female employee, then the law allows the employer to nominate the presiding officer from any other offices or other organizations. In addition to the presiding officer, there are two members who are committed to the cause of women, or have some experience in social work, or have legal knowledge, who will also need to comprise the ICC. And finally, this law clarifies that there will need to be an external participation within the ICC. And one member will need to be either from a non-government organization or any other women's organization, or somebody who's familiar with issues in relation to sexual harassment. So again, there was some confusion based on the Supreme Court guidelines whether it was mandatory to have an external member as part of the complaints committee. And this law clarifies that it is mandatory to have an external member as part of the ICC. In situations where it is not possible to set up an ICC, for example, in an organization that has less than 10 employees, the government will be setting up what is known as a local complaints committee at every district. And to that extent, in absence of an ICC, a female employee reserves the right to approach the local complaints committee. Obviously, that means that the matter will go out of the hands of the employer and will be handled by an external organization. But that's the right given to a female employee under law to approach an LCC directly formed by the government. Also, in cases where the allegation of sexual harassment is against the employer himself, the female employee is also permitted to approach the LCC directly. But in all other cases, you know, the female employee has to use the internal complaints committee mechanism that has been set up by the employer. Just touching upon the grievance redressal process, you know, the new law puts in perspective the process that needs to be followed in case a female employee alleges sexual harassment and has some stringent timelines associated with it. For example, in a situation where there is an incident of sexual harassment, the female employee has to report that incident within 3 months by way of a complaint to be made in writing to the complaints committee. And if the female employee, for whatever reason, does not make the complaint within 3 months of the date of the incident, then it needs to, you know, it has a further extension of 3 months, although it has to give the reasons for delay in writing. Once the ICC, obtains the complaint, the process under law will begin in terms of investigating the matter. But in the interim, the new law also has provisions in relation to, the female employee approaching for conciliation if she does not want the ICC to investigate the matter, but would be happy with some sort of a conciliation. Although, again, the law clarifies that there would be no monetary settlement as a result of the conciliation. The law also provides temporary relief to the female employee while the investigation is ongoing. Once, the inquiry commences, the ICC is given 90 days to kind of complete the inquiry, and again there are detailed provisions under the law in terms of how the ICC is and the rules sorry in terms of how the ICC is required to investigate the matter. But the thumb rule is that the ICC would be required to follow the principles of natural justice while investigating the allegations. And as a result, we'll need to allow the accused and the complainant to, be heard as part of the inquiry process. Once the ICC concludes its inquiry, it has to report its findings within 10 days to the employer and to the parties. So a copy of the report also has to be submitted to the complainant and to the harasser, along with to the employer. In a situation where the allegation has been proved based on the ICC's investigation, the ICC reserves the right to recommend the punishment to the employer. Again, the rules provide the details of the punishment that could be inflicted. In a situation where allegation is not proved, obviously there is no action that needs to be taken by the employer. But, there is a provision under the law which says that if the allegation of sexual harassment are of a false or malicious nature, then to that extent the employer reserves the right to take appropriate disciplinary action against the complainant. So that appears to be a sort of a provision that could act as a deterrent to female employees who may have genuine case but may not have adequate evidence to prove the act of sexual harassment. Although, again, the law clarifies that inability to substantiate the complaint by itself or inability to provide adequate documentation does not really mean that it is a false or a malicious intention. The interim relief, the law provides for certain interim relief to the complainant while the inquiry and the investigation is going on, and that includes transfer of the female employee or the respondent to any other workplace of the employer, or to provide leave of up to 3 months to the complainant. The law provides the broad parameters of compensation to the female employee in situation where the allegation is proved based on the inquiry. And it says that the employer will take into consideration various aspects, including the mental trauma, pain, suffering, and emotional distress that caused, and the potential loss in career opportunity as a result of such an incident, while determining the compensation payable to the victim of sexual harassment. The law does not really provide for any monetary thresholds or limits, but just provides for the broad parameters that need to be considered while determining the compensation in case the allegations of sexual harassment has been proved. The law and the rules cast several obligations upon the employer in relation to providing a safe and conducive working environment, and to ensure that the employer is able to prevent cases of sexual harassment. Some of the obligations imposed include displaying at the workplace at certain central locations the penal consequences of indulging in such acts of sexual harassment, composition of the committee as I discussed earlier, the grievance redressal mechanism available to the aggrieved employees. The employer is required to organize workshops and awareness programs for sensitizing employees, and that is something that a lot of companies have started doing, where there are sort of both the legal aspects as well as case studies, where employees are aware of are made aware of what situations of what are situations that could lead to sexual harassment, and what are their rights under law, and also sort of going through the policy so that they know how to act in certain situations where they feel sexually harassed. The employer is also required to organize orientation programs for the members of the internal complaint committee. And the law has said that the members of the committee shall hold their office for up to 3 years. So after every 3 years, the ICC members will be required to be changed. And as a result, this is something that again would be an ongoing obligation of the employer. Obviously, when there is a complaint of sexual harassment, the employer is required to cooperate and assist during the course of the inquiry. Also ensure that, in its service rules or in its employee handbook under the section on misconduct, there is a reference to sexual harassment as an example of misconduct. There is a requirement for the employer to assist the female employee in filing a police complaint, and we will talk a bit subsequently in this webinar on the provisions under the penal code. But should the female employee wish, then it is the responsibility and an obligation upon the employer to provide assistance to such a female employee to file a police complaint. In addition, there are a requirement of submission of annual reports in the prescribed format to the district officer in relation to providing various details about the number of cases of sexual harassment that had come up in the organization in a particular year. The law prescribes certain penalty for the failure on the part of the employer to constitute an ICC, or in terms of contravention of any other provision of the new law. There is a fine of 50,000 rupees, that's about $800, that has been imposed as a penalty. But in case of continuing offence, there is a stricter penalty that has been imposed, which is basically cancellation of business license. This is really the first time we've seen a labor law where such a stringent penalty has been enforced upon the employer for non-compliance. And all offences under the new law are considered as non-cognizable. I'll request my colleague Ajay to maybe touch upon the provisions that were added under the Indian Penal Code while this law was being formulated. And he's also going to spend a few minutes on the provisions that have been added under the rules that, as I mentioned earlier, were implemented last week. Thank you.
Thank you, Vikram. Good evening, everyone. Basically, in the Indian Penal Code in the year 2013, in the wake of a lot of activity that happened after the unfortunate event in 2012 in the Delhi rape case, the government was under a lot of pressure to come up with a law that would basically be in respect of empowering women or helping out women in situations which related to, say, sexual harassment or maybe some other criminal acts that were rampant in India. And as a step towards it, the government came up with an amendment to the Indian Penal Code by inserting a section, section 354A, as an extension to an earlier section which was in respect of increasing the modesty of a woman. Basically, as an extension to that, a section on sexual harassment as such was added to the Indian Penal Code. The definition of sexual harassment under this particular section is somewhat similar to what was mentioned in the Vishakha guidelines, as well as what has been mentioned in the law that has been notified recently. The amount of punishment that has been, or the quantum of punishment that has been provided for under the Indian Penal Code ranges from 1 year to 3 years, depending upon the graveness of the crime, the gravity of the crime. For example, in respect of, say, passing sexually colored remarks, the Indian Penal Code says that the punishment can be for about 1 year, whereas for other graver kind of instances, for example, physical contact and advances or sexual favors, the punishment can range up to a term of 3 years. The law also imposes a fine on the perpetrator, and it can be even both punishments as well as fines. Apart from Section 354A, obviously there are other sections in the Indian Penal Code which may be invoked by the person aggrieved, depending upon the nature of crime or depending upon the nature of act by the perpetrator. Just moving on to the rules which have been recently notified on December 9th, 2013, along with the notification of the effective date of the Sexual Harassment Act. The rules prescribe for a lot of aspects which were left out within the Act for an explanation or for an extension to the Act. First of all, the rules prescribe for remuneration which may be paid to the members of the committee as well as the chairperson. It prescribes for 200 rupee per day remuneration per member as well as a 250 rupee remuneration for the chairperson along with a reimbursement of the travel expenses that may be incurred by the member or the chairperson. Secondly, it also goes on to define who a person familiar with the issues of sexual harassment may be, and it goes on to define it to say it can be a social worker who has about 5 years of experience in the field of social work, which leads to say creation of societal conditions which are favorable to women or which are for women empowerment, as well as it can be a person who is familiar with labor, service, civil or criminal law. The rules also talk about the mechanism of filing a complaint in a case where the complainant may not be able to file the case because of some physical or a mental incapacity or because of any other reason. And the rules basically prescribe that it can be the complaint can be filed through any friend or a colleague or a co-worker or anybody who is aware of the situation can file a complaint on behalf of such a person. The rules also prescribe for the procedure which has to be followed during the inquiry. So basically the rules envisage that the inquiry should be in accordance with the principles of natural justice. Basically it also goes on to say that the inquiry officer may be allowed to pass an ex parte judgment in a case where the perpetrator is not has not reported in front of the inquiry officer. It also the rules also go on to say that basically either of the parties, the perpetrator as well as the person aggrieved, may not be represented by a legal practitioner as far as these internal inquiry proceedings are concerned. The rules also talk of reliefs which the complainant may be granted in respect while the inquiry proceedings are pending, which have also though been written in the Act as well. But then the rules also additionally go on to say that basically any kind of performance evaluation which may have been done by the perpetrator in the past, the perpetrator may not be allowed to do a performance evaluation of the complainant going forward after the alleged act. The rules also provide for the manner an action that may be taken, the manner in which an action may be taken by the employer or by the district officer, as the case may be in case of an ICC or maybe an LCC, in respect of the perpetrator, as well as in cases where there is a malicious or false complaint filed by the complainant. Basically, the rules say that it can be in the form of warning or censure or reprimand or going on to the extent of termination of employment of the person concerned, whether it may be the complainant or the perpetrator. The rules also prescribe for an appellate authority in case any of the persons is aggrieved from the recommendations of the complaints committee. Further, the rules also prescribe for a 5,000 rupee fine over a person who basically discloses any confidential information in respect of the whole inquiry proceedings or in respect of the whole act. Finally, the rules also prescribe for basically the manner in which workshops may be organized by the organization, the orientation programs that would be required for the members of the committee or the chairperson, and also for any orientation programs in respect of the employees for making them aware of the position of law, the act as it stands today. And finally, the rules also prescribe for the kind of information that is to be disclosed in an annual report to the extent of the number of complaints filed, to the extent of the number of complaints that have been already disposed of, and related aspects. I would now like to hand over the mic to Vikram, who would deal with the analysis of the whole act.
Thanks, Ajay. So that was basically a summary of the act and the rules and basically the obligations of the employer. We've obviously been looking at this development very closely over the last several months. As such, the law really only protects female employees. There is no protection for male employees. So while it's a good start, we were hoping that the law would be broad enough to cover and provide protection even for male employees from sexual harassment. So while it's a good start, maybe I think over time we would hope to see that the scope of the law is broadened to include or provide some level of protection to male employees as well. And that is something that is not uncommon in the scheme of things. There is no reference to protection from victimization. Now, in fact, just today's Economic Times, if you had a chance to read, has an article on a female employee who had alleged sexual harassment. And currently, she remains unemployed because no other employer really wants to take her. It seems that no headhunters or recruitment agencies have been approaching her in recent times, because of the fact that the case is ongoing. And it's quite disappointing to note, but and it's possibly sad but true, that you know, this is what eventually you know, happens. Hopefully, you know, the industry will come out of this and will be able to look at it on its merits. But it would have been helpful if the law had a sort of provided some level of protection from victimization of the complainant. There is lack of clarity in terms of constitution of ICC for different offices. And we've been getting a lot of questions over the last few months as to, you know, clients who have offices at several cities in India, or even multiple offices within the same city, and whether they can have the same ICC, or whether they will need to set up different committees for different offices. While the law obviously looks at it from the fact that, you know, each office will need to comprise or set up an ICC. Employers are looking at some level of flexibility, especially because they would want the ICC to be uniform, or, you know, have some level of common members, so that at the end of the day, the decision-making process for similar cases is uniform in nature. The law has made it mandatory to have external representation within the ICC. While that is good in a way, because it brings that level of independence, you know, obviously, in view of the sensitivity surrounding sexual harassment allegations at the workplace, employers are not going to be comfortable in involving external members within the ICC. So that's obviously a cause of concern that has been expressed. The timelines that have been prescribed for the ICC to conduct the inquiry and conclude the matter at times may be unrealistic, especially in view of the you know, nature of allegations, the kind of evidence that may go into it, the number of witnesses that may be involved. So it's obviously a very complicated process, and sometimes it may be difficult for the ICC to practically complete the entire inquiry within the timeline specified. A clause where the employer is allowed to take action for false and malicious complaint is looked at as a deterrent by several female employees, especially in situations where they may not really have adequate evidence to support their case. And, you know, that could be looked at as if, you know, it could deter employees from making complaints in genuine cases. There are, you know, lack of provisions on how an employer would go about deducting from the harasser's salary if the complaint is proved successfully. There are provisions under other labor laws, including the Payment of Wages Act, as to how much can you really deduct from the salary. And those provisions may restrict the employer from deducting the level of damages from the harasser's salary. Again, you know, the monetary liabilities imposed upon the employer do not appear to be that extensive in nature, especially in view of, you know, the importance of this particular subject. The law at this moment is, another point to go is that it's only limited to sexual harassment. It does not cover harassment on other grounds like race, color, origin, etc. So maybe over time, the law may need to be expanded to cover other forms of harassment. In under the rules, the amounts, the fees that the NGO members can charge appears a bit on the lower side. And that, again, is a cause of concern as to whether, you know, employers will be able to get, you know, good employees from NGOs as part of their committee. And also the penalty for disclosure of confidential information is prescribed to be 5,000 rupees. Again, in view of the nature of, you know, the importance of confidentiality in these kind of matters, 5,000 rupees appears very low from that context. So this is broadly our analysis of this new law, and we are happy to now take up any questions that you may have in relation to this act or the rules thereunder.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on a touch-tone telephone. Participants are requested to use only handsets while asking a question. Anyone has a question at this time may press star and one. We're going to take a first question from the line of Chinmaya Joshi from Principal Determinant. Please go ahead.
See, I have this question that on slide number 29, point number 10, it is written that information to be provided in the annual report. So is it the company's annual report where we should provide this information, or is it the report provided by ICC?
So just to answer your question, basically what the law prescribes, the act as well as the rules prescribe, that on an annual basis, the committee as well as the employer have to submit the report to the concerned authorities. To that extent, the annual report and whatever information that is required to be submitted as per the rules is to be submitted in the annual report, which is being submitted by the committee. As well as the same annual report which is prepared by the committee has to be separately submitted by the employer as well. So considering that the committee in itself is different, in such cases the committee in itself is different from the employer, to that extent the employer as well as the committee have to submit the annual report.
Well, just to add, I mean, the way you look at it, it's really going to be the employer's responsibility in terms of the annual report. It's really the labor authorities are going to check with the employer whether they have submitted the annual report rather than the committee. So looking at it practically, I would say it is going to be the responsibility of the employer to submit the annual report in the prescribed format.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have some more questions, Mr. Joshi?
No further questions.
Next question from the line of Reena Jalan from Infrastructure Standard and Living. Please go ahead. Ms. Reena, your line is unmuted. Please ask a question.
Hello. So my question is, in case of constitution of ICC, can we have a common ICC for the holding company as well as the subsidiary company?
So, Reena, actually, as I said a bit earlier, there have been a lot of questions on the composition of the ICC. Now, the preference is to have an ICC for each office or for each establishment to the extent possible. And in a situation where, for whatever reason, you are unable to have an ICC constituted at that entity level, you will have to look at, affiliate entities or, other offices of that employer to kind of determine the ICC. So to respond to your question, the answer is yes, it should be possible. But at some stage, you will have to look at it as to why you could not set up the ICC at the other entities level. And why did the ICC have to be common across the board? So as long as you can provide a justification as to why you did that, I think that should be fine. But just a related point is, if your company and your affiliate have different offices in different cities across the country, then to that extent, having an ICC set up at one location may not necessarily serve the purpose envisaged under the new law. And the way the new law, the provisions have been shaped, the intention was to have an ICC at each office or at each sort of unit of the organization.
Just one related thing is, the Act is not very clear on this. So if we take a possible justification to say that the holding company and the subsidiary company just wants to have one common ICC, because of the number of employees or because it's more feasible to have one common ICC, like for all the offices, for the holding company and subsidiary company may have offices all over India, but for Mumbai it can be only one ICC which is constituted. So it's not that there is any justification, but it's just that, it's easy for everyone.
No, I agree with you. So that's also, we were actually hoping that the rules come out with some flexibility in this respect. Unfortunately, the rules have just not referred to the composition of ICC in relation to these kind of situations. And really, the only provision under the law is that in a situation where you are unable to set up the ICC because of lack of senior level employees, then you can have senior level employees from other offices of that employer or from other affiliates. So I would, the way I would look at it is that as long as you have a reasonable justification as to why an ICC is common for different offices within the city, I think that should suffice. But also look at it from the perspective that the law applies to each entity. So in your case, if there are multiple entities, and if each of those multiple entities on its own is able to form an ICC without needing employees from the other organization, then I think you would be better off doing that rather than risking it by having a central or a neutral ICC which contains employees from one organization and have got no relationship with the other organization. You also have to look at it from a female employee's perspective, because she would be more comfortable in taking up the matter with people whom she may know, people whom she would have worked with, that form the ICC, rather than employees of an affiliate whom she would have sort of no connection.
Okay, then the other thing you were just mentioning was on the workplaces, to have the ICC at different workplaces. So is there anything that, you know, one ICC has to be in one district, or it can be one ICC in one ICC in Delhi, one in Bombay, one in Chennai, something like that? So what is the criteria? Because the way the Act reads, it's very unclear to say. It just says that ICC has to be at different places where the administrative units are located. So how do you one interpret that?
Yeah, so actually the Act has not gone on to describe these kind of situations where, as I said earlier, company having multiple offices and again having multiple offices within the same city or having affiliates and all, the law has not really gone on to provide clarity for those kind of situations. So as I said earlier, you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. And to the extent you're able to set up an ICC for each office, for each employer, that's obviously the best case situation to be in. But if not, then that's where you try for some of these permutations and combinations with the hope that you are trying to comply with the requirements under the law to the extent possible and have justification or reasons as to why you've deviated from those provisions. So for example, let's say you have two offices in Mumbai. In one office, you have senior level employees, and these two offices are within the same company or within the same employer. In one office, you have senior level female employees or experienced enough to kind of form the ICC, and in the other, you just have junior level female employees. Then I believe that could form a justification as to why you have a common ICC for both those offices.
Yeah, my question was basically, can we have one ICC in one state?
No, again, as I said, this is not clarified under the law. So the law does not really look at it from a state-specific perspective. You have to look at it from each entity level. So if in a particular state you have offices in several cities, and each city is in a position, has senior-level female employees or employees experienced enough to form ICC, then you may not have adequate justification to have one state-wise ICC.
Okay, I guess the law is not still clear, so we'll have to, it's just an evolving law, so maybe further clarifications are awaited. So.
Exactly, we were hoping this comes under the rules, but unfortunately that did not happen.
Yeah, because it's very difficult to comply with. Even if we want to comply, we just can't comply with it, because it's practical, not feasible, then it will just happen that we will be having just ICCs and not doing any other work.
Yeah, and especially when... you also have to keep training the ICC members, and also the fact that the ICC members need to be changed every 3 years. So you're correct in that perspective that, that level of flexibility has not been provided under the law.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for this.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Deepa Nair from Multiscreen Media. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. See, Pajit, the definition of the term sexual harassment under Section 2N, and if I compare it with the amendment to the IPC under Section 354, there are certain examples which are similar. So in such a case, is it compulsory for me to report every sexual harassment incident to the police, or can I just employees find everything is settled within the company.
So, Deepa, the question relates to whether what is the obligation cast upon the employer to file, with the police authority. There is a provision under the law which says that you are responsible to help the female employee make a police complaint. That is what has been specified as the employer's duties. Now, the penal code provision and the provision under the new law are different in the nature that the provision under the Indian Penal Code applies across the board and it's not really limited to workplace, whereas the law is only in relation to workplace. So in a situation where an act is considered as sexual harassment under the new law as well as under the penal code, then to that extent, if the female employee, the victim insists, then to that extent, you as the employer need to assist her in filing the police complaint. But in a situation where, it's an act of sexual harassment against the under the act, but is not envisaged as a sexual harassment under the Indian Penal Code, then to that extent, there may not be much merit in filing under Section 354A of the Indian Penal Code, and to that extent, you may need to rely on any other sections of the Indian Penal Code if you do want to file a police complaint.
Absolutely. The only question is it in case it overlaps with Section 354A, does it make it mandatory for me to report it even if I don't want to? I mean, even if the employer, the victim does not want to, or does it, will I be obliged to report it to the police because it's a penal action that the company is aware of?
See, so as I said, the law provides requires the employer to report to the police authority only if the female employee wishes to file with the police authority. So in a situation where you don't want to file, that's fine. You can simply tell the employer that you're not interested in taking this external to the police authority.
All right. The other question I have is under Section 6(1), the victim is allowed to go to the LCC if the two options are, one, if the office has less than 10 members and ICC is not constituted, or if it's against the company. Now, the employer. So when I see the term employer, would the definition also include the CEO, or are we talking purely in cases of proprietorship or partnership is when this section will apply?
Well, so CEO is not necessarily the employer. It really has to be looked at on a case-by-case situation. A CEO has is responsible for the management, supervision, and control of the workplace may be the employer situations where it's a designation and like there is a sort of a broad committee, board of directors, and CEO doesn't have adequate powers, it's all with the board, then to that extent, he may not fall within the definition of employer. So it's really what kind of responsibility or authority he has to determine whether he is the employer or not. In fact, there are some other labor laws where you have to name the manager, and if you name the CEO as the manager, then it would mean that he is considered somebody who has control of the affairs of the establishment, and to that extent would come within the definition of employer. So to that extent, I would believe that you have the right to approach the LCC directly, because obviously you feel that the ICC, even though it has external representation, because of the fact that it's a complaint against the CEO, who is the highest authority in the organization, there may not, you may not really get justice. So it needs to be looked at on a case-by-case situation and see, what kind of power that person has and whether he falls within the definition of employer. It's a fairly extensive definition under the new law.
Absolutely, absolutely. And similarly, in the case where they're saying that, that the victim can approach the LCC if there are less than 10 members. So suppose if I have an admin office which has less than 10 members and I haven't constituted an ICC there, but my head office has an ICC, does it make it mandatory for the victim to approach the head office? Or does she have the provision of directly go to the LCC and get this? case heard.
No, so if that particular office has less than 10 employees and therefore you don't need to set up an ICC for that particular office, the victim has a right to approach the LCC set up in that district directly without referring to the ICC at the central location. Obviously, when you're drafting your policies, you want to encourage your employees to approach the ICC to the extent possible if you already formed one. Because to the extent you are able to resolve the matter internally, you really don't want to take it externally. So when we are working on policies for our clients, we are basically trying to encourage female employees to use the internal redressal mechanism rather than going outside.
Absolutely, absolutely. But no, although I might have it formulated in my policy, the Act is very clear. It says that, you know, it's in continuation and not in derogation. The victim will always have the right to go to the LCC without coming to me.
Correct.
Okay. In case of a conciliation, when they're saying that the...
Sorry for that, Deepa. There are a few other questions lined up. Take your question subsequently. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I request you to ask a question. Next question from the line of Priya Anathanan from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, Vikram. Thanks for taking us through the new provisions. I just had a question regarding the rules that have been notified now. Rule number 7, sub-rule 6, I believe, wherein it states that the parties are not allowed to bring in any legal practitioner to represent them. So isn't that some kind of a paradox in the sense that every, you know, a labor inquiry as well, where a workman is allowed to bring a legal practitioner? And as a subset to this question, I also wanted to know, in that case, can an advocate who is supposed to be a third-party expert or an internal legal counsel cannot be an ICC member?
So it's obviously unfortunate for us lawyers to not be able to represent clients in these matters. But this particular provision is not actually deviating from the process for internal disciplinary inquiry in order to prove the act of misconduct, where also employees are barred from having external lawyers represent them in the internal disciplinary inquiry process. So this was not something that was unexpected. This was obviously something that we expected, as consistent with other labor law provisions, where employers are barred from having external lawyers represent them. But I agree with you that in a situation where a female employee may not be articulate enough or may not be able to put her case that confidently, the presence of a lawyer would definitely have helped. But again, because of this restriction, I think the female employee can her colleagues working in the organization to support her, but cannot really, have someone external as a lawyer to represent her case.
Thanks, Vikram. So in that case, an in-house counsel can also not act as an ICC member, or can we have...
No. So, sorry. So just to clarify, Priya, this is only for, who represents the victim while the ICC is investigating the matter. So this is limited to that point. I don't think there is any restriction in having an in-house counsel form part of the ICC.
Or an advocate who is practicing but who is well-versed in social work and labor laws.
That's also fine. See, this provision under the rules is not in relation to forming the ICC. It is in relation to the inquiry process and who can represent the victim.
Understand. Thanks, Vikram.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, in order to ensure that the speaker is able to address questions from all the participants in the conference, please limit your questions to one per participant. Next question from the line of Supriya Sood from EXL. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Supriya Sood. Thanks for the wonderful presentation. My question is whether a female employee can insist that simultaneously she wants the employer to assist her in filing a police complaint and also to hold the inquiry under the 2013 Act. Can she insist upon that?
Yes, she can insist on both. the employer obviously has the obligation under the new law to investigate the matter through the ICC. So that is obviously something under the law. And the Indian Penal Code, which is obviously a separate law altogether, a victim can also approach the police authorities directly. And the police will also pursue the matter if if they do take up and register an FIR. So both can happen simultaneously in a situation where the allegation is proved. The employer can terminate the harasser's employment, while the police can actually the police sort of investigation can eventually lead to imprisonment. So both can happen simultaneously or parallelly.
Okay, thanks a lot. Another question. I'm sorry you asked for one question, but again, if you kindly permit me to ask one small question.
Yes.
Actually, one of our senior female employee, who is a presiding officer of the internal committee, can she be the presiding officer for our 7 location across country? While we will have different members, of course, different committee members in all the locations, but the presiding officer would be the same. Can we have that? Because she is the only senior most member in the company.
No, so I appreciate the question. That flexibility has not been provided under the legislation. So if your other offices in the company are able to have a senior level employee as the presiding officer, then that's the preference. But because you are having a common presiding officer due to lack of senior level female employees in other locations, that justification may be valid for having a common presiding officer. But I think the preference, as I said earlier, would be to try and see if you can get a presiding officer at every location rather than having a common presiding officer.
Right. Thanks a lot. That was really useful. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Next question from the line of A.H. Kumar from Dr. Reddy. Please go ahead.
Hi, good evening. Question is, when does this law really come into force? I know it's December 9, 2013, but does it relate to the date of the offense or the misbehavior, the date of the inquiry conclusion, the date of the award, or the date of the communication to the respondent and the complainant?
So it would be the date the female employee chooses to make the complaint is when you will have to see whether that has to be done, whether the investigation needs to happen under the new law or under the old law. So if a complaint happens on or after December 9th, then you will have to ensure that you follow the provisions of the new law. If the complaint happened prior to December 9th, you have the flexibility of referring to the old law or considering the provisions of the new law. Our recommendation would be that to the extent you can comply with the new law, even for a complaint that came before December 9th, that is a preference, because the new law goes into details of the procedural aspects, which otherwise also would have needed to be followed. For example, complying with the principles of natural justice, you would also have to have done that under the previous law. So even though the previous law was silent, you will have to comply with those provisions. So now that the new law has gone into extensive details of the procedural aspects, the recommendation would be that you're better off complying to the provisions of the new law to the extent possible.
Okay, thanks. If you allow me, I just want to expand on an earlier question, which is, I think, a very critical question regarding police. Do I have the permission to do so? Can I ask?
Yes, please.
One delicate situation will be, especially in remote areas, like a company like us has got manufacturing in remote areas. A female employee who is perhaps not from that area may just confide in the ICC, saying that, look, and it could be physical assault as well. Not just merely pornography or something like that, but something involving physical crime, like, actually grabbing a person or things like that. Now, she comes and confides in you, and she has got nobody else, and, we all have a great love for the police in this country. So that puts a great onus on a responsible employer or a senior manager to take a decision. Should they stop there and say, it's your choice after all, or should because it happened the premises, maybe you know, the psychologically the woman has been hurt. There could be, you know, more serious offenses, like, you know, or the woman could hurt herself or do something like that. So where do you really draw the line about proactively reporting to the police?
Well, so I think it's something that is going to evolve, and I think we'll know how to go about with it, because today the responsibility to inform the police only lies when the female employee really wants you to do that. But again, I think the situation that you mentioned, I mean, this is something that happens, you know, at all levels, and typically a female employee may not be comfortable approaching the ICC or the police directly. You know, they may simply confine into her manager or, you know, somebody whom, a colleague, you know, where she has kind of more trust or faith. So I think, you know, when we are working on these policies for our clients, we kind of also make it a responsibility upon the manager or other employees that if they hear of any allegations and all, they should be encouraging the female employee to use the redressal mechanism provided by the employer, rather than, you know, just ignoring it or, you know, shoving it under the carpet. So, you know, that's something that, you know, it's a matter of education amongst your employees at what level they feel that, you know, they need to support this employee and kind of, you know, encourage her to, you know, approach the committee.
My friend, sorry, I don't think you got my question right. Woman employees, let's say the previous thing of somebody having assaulted and then continues to stalk the person. It's a remote place, or even it's a big city. The woman employee is not willing to go to the police. You know, I'm not talking here about assisting. I'm talking about under Criminal Procedure Code, under IPC, any person, citizen, is under responsibility to report a crime. Now, if the woman employee, like, can be expected, says, sorry, I don't want to do anything with the police, but then you know that's going to be serious consequences, like the guy continues to stalk her. Now, where do you really... at one point, are you obligated, in your opinion, to go to the police and tell whether the woman employee wants you to do it or not?
So, I mean, okay, so if it's a matter of sexual harassment, it's obviously at a different level. And if it's another form of assault, you know, then obviously there are other provisions under the Indian Penal Code, which we may not be able to advise you at this stage because we are not really criminal lawyers.
I mean, again, assault by, I mean, somebody has, let's say, forced himself on a woman. Like, that's assault, I mean, not general assault on the IPC.
Yeah. So, I mean, if it's an assault in relation to sexual harassment, I mean, it's hard to answer the question as to where you draw the line. I mean, it's obviously each person's discretion as to, you know, how much is she suffering. I mean, now that the awareness has increased about dealing in sexual harassment and related crimes, obviously can't go beyond a point to keep telling people that please keep going to the police or please approach the ICC. Each manager or each sort of employee will have to take some level of discretion and kind of guide the female employee that, you know, you can stop this by, you know, approaching the management or the ICC or the police authorities. So it's really a case-specific situation. I mean, the way I look at it, it's really thanks to the new law. That, you know, the awareness has grown significantly over the last few months, and a lot of companies are, you know, conducting training programs and, you know, seminars on how to deal with these kind of situations. What is sexual harassment? What is not sexual harassment?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, in order to ensure that the management is able to address questions from all participants in the conference, please limit your questions to one per participant. Next question from the line of Chirag Bhagat from Goodyear India Limited. Please go ahead.
Hi, NDA team. Thanks a lot for the wonderful session. Here I want to ask a question that an obligation has been casted upon the employer to include the number of cases filed and their disposal in the annual report. So it means the annual report of the organization, main annual report, or the annual report which has been submitted by the ICC or LCC to the district officer?
No, this is the annual report to the district officer. It's not the annual report that you would file under company's law.
Oh. Okay, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Sudha Huda from Amdocs. Please go ahead.
Sudha?
Ms. Sudha, your line is unmuted. Please ask your question. We shall take a next question from the line of Isha Chakravarti from Aegis. Please go ahead.
Hi. My question is with respect to the nature of the policy now. We are a BPO company, and even before the inception of this act, we already had a gender harassment policy which was neutral in nature. So in that case, whether it be a man or a woman employee, if they were a victim of sexual harassment, they could come ahead and sort of follow the norms of the policy and register the complaint. Now here, this act specifically mandates policy with respect to women. So now, are we required to have, two separate policies, or is it okay if we, just have a single policy and we capture the spirit of this act in the gender-neutral policy?
So,
meant it in any way from having a policy with wide ambit?
Yeah, so I think most multinational companies or most progressive organizations continue to have a gender-neutral policy, irrespective of the fact that the law provides protection only for female employees. So I would actually, if you already have an anti-harassment policy covering both the male and female employees, you just want to expand the scope of the policy to ensure that the requirements under the new law are complied with. Now, in a situation where you feel that some requirements, for example, the process to be followed by the ICC or otherwise it's a bit too onerous, then you can limit those to, a case of allegation of sexual harassment by a female employee and leave the other generic provisions for male employees. So it's a call you want to take as to how you want to craft your policy and what provisions you feel are kind of comfortable in both situations and what provisions you feel that you want to limit it only to female employees.
Okay. Thanks a lot. That was quite helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Somi Alpan from SAS. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Somi Alpan. My question was on, some time ago you mentioned about compensation of the complainant and also some bit of discussion on harasser's salary deduction. Could you help me to understand a little more on that?
Okay, so the law has provisions that if the harasser's act has indeed been found, he's been found guilty of sexual harassment, the committee or the employer can require the harasser to make certain compensation to the victim. Now, the thresholds for the compensation have not been mentioned, but the parameters which need to be considered to determine the compensation has been specified. Now, in a situation where, let's say, a particular amount has been decided by the employer as compensation payable to the victim for, being sexually harassed by the harasser, the harasser may choose not to pay, right? And in a situation where he does not pay that amount or it's the amount is too high, the point is that does the employer have the ability to deduct from his salary and pay that amount to the victim is a question mark, because there are other labor laws such as the Payment of Wages Act where the total amount of deductions from salary have been limited. So, how able would an employer be legally speaking to actually deduct those amounts from the salary? Because if the harasser refuses to pay, then what do you do? You obviously don't want to take it to the court.
Right. So this may be the same thing for a fine of 5,000 that you mentioned. How would you deduct that?
So the fine of 5,000 is actually for disclosure of confidential information. And that
yes.
could happen by anybody. It's not really limited to the harasser or anyone. Even a witness could end up disclosing that, this person has filed a complaint of sexual harassment.
Right.
So anyone could be subjected to that fine.
But even that has to be shown as deduction, and I don't know how the taxation would take it and how would it be represented in salary deduction.
Yeah, I think it will be the same issue. I agree with you. That's correct.
What do you propose in this?
Well, there isn't clarity legally as to how the employer would be able to deduct, because there is another law that restricts the ability to deduct. So I think it's an issue, and hopefully there might be amendments in the future allowing the employer to deduct from salary for any sort of fine or compensation for sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next question from the line of Shankar Parmeshwaran from ICICI Bank. Please go ahead.
Well, I have a very peculiar question, in the sense, when you engage outsourced employees, especially contractors whose people come and work on your premises, and if it's an allegation by the contracted workman, to whom does the complaint go to? To my bank's committee or to his employer's committee?
So, as I understand, the definition of employee...
Excuse, enough.
Yeah, sorry. As I understand, the definition of employee is broad enough to also include contract laborers.
Right.
A situation where a female contract laborer working at your office alleges sexual harassment, it actually goes to you. You as the employer are responsible to take up the matter and ensure that your ICC investigates.
What I want to make it clear is the complainant is the employee of the outsourced contractor, and the harassment is at the hands of my employee. There are two different employers now.
So the question, so just to understand, are you telling us that the contract labor who got harassed was harassed by your employee?
Exactly.
At your office.
At my workplace.
Yeah, then you will be responsible as the employer, because the definition of employee under the new law also includes a contract worker.
Okay. But can they use the facilities of both the committees at her place and at my place?
Well, so I think you will have the primary responsibility under law. And to that extent, I don't see why he would need to use the contractor's ICC, because the incident happened at your workplace.
Okay.
And under law, you're responsible.
No, once again, somebody else asked, she'll be far more familiar with her people than my people.
No, I agree. So that's obviously a sort of a convenience issue.
Right.
But at the same time, we also have to look at it as to who is obligated under law, and you as the principal employer would be obligated, because the definition of employee includes a contract laborer, and plus the incident happened at your workplace.
Okay. Thank you. I have just an incidental short question. When the committee gives its recommendations, do they have to justify the recommendations on punishment, etc., or do you leave it to the employer to decide?
No, it's required.
So it's really up to the committee. What they would recommend, like a punishment, like any committee would recommend or an inquiry officer would recommend as a disciplinary action, we would expect this committee to do that. And I think at some level, there will have to be some level of justification as to why they arrived at a particular decision, and not just stop at saying that this is our decision. So I would expect the committee to do a bit more than arriving at the decision by providing in their report some level of justification.
And does the employer have the flexibility to increase the punishment?
Yes, definitely. I mean, see, the committee will only look at it as a one-off incident. Whereas if the employer looks at it as, even the employee's past history, and depending on, how it goes about, it can always, in consideration of the past history, enforce a different level of punishment. Typically, we wouldn't recommend the employer to do something beyond what is recommended by the committee, unless the employer is like very confident as to why it is prescribing a higher penalty. I mean, that's not normally something that we would recommend the employer to do.
But what about the reverse, reducing the punishment?
That is fine, because committee can only provide a recommendation. The employer can take, has the discretion to finally award that level of punishment. And obviously, the punishment inflicted should be proportionate to the act of misconduct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Kanika Bhutani from Ernst & Young. Please go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to ask Vikram if there are any guidelines for investigation that the ICC must follow.
Correct.
Are there any guidelines in the investigation process or the general process that the ICC must follow? Because when you read the act, it's quite generic.
I think you should also refer to the rules where some additional guidelines have been prescribed. Again, I would say they're a bit generic in nature, but at least it gives some level of reference to the ICC. So if you refer to the rules, there are some provisions there under in terms of, you know, how the ICC needs to go about making the inquiry.
Fair enough. And can a aggrieved party or the female complain through any mechanism, or does she have to complain to the Internal Complaints Committee if she doesn't know about the ICC? Can she complain anywhere else, like a whistleblower line or anything else?
Well, if you have those channels, you should, you know, employees are allowed to do that. But again, if you look at it, the law says that the complaint needs to be made to the ICC and 6 copies of the complaint needs to be submitted along with evidence. So if the law has gone into so much of details, you should be encouraging the employee to, you know, follow what the law requires her to do, rather than, you know, using the sort of ethics line or the whistleblowing line. You know, those things could really be for other forms of harassment or discrimination, but for cases of sexual harassment, you're better off following what has been prescribed under the law.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Arun Taneja from TCS. Please go ahead.
Now there is no provision for to safeguard the interest of male employees. You know, like we have seen in 406 and 490, a lot of exploitation is happening. What is there any in the penal Indian Penal Code? Can this, the male employees, if it is coming out as a malice case, can the person reach out to the court of law or?
I think under the Indian Penal Code provisions, yes, except for sexual harassment, some of the other provisions are gender neutral. So to that extent, I would believe the answer is yes. You'll have to see whether the police authorities are ready to kind of take up the case and file an FIR. But I don't think most of the, I would believe that most of the provisions are gender neutral in that nature. So you should be able to rely on the other provisions of the Indian Penal Code.
No, the question is when there's Section 6354, which is there under which the, let's say there's the ITC code, IPC code is there. Now, in this case, suppose the lady employee files a case. No, it goes to the court of law. Now, what is the provision this person would have now to repeal or?
So, actually, unfortunately, we are not criminal law experts to answer that question.
I am asking under this section 354A, there is a, which is IPC, and this lady employee files a case. So now under this, now that means the other party as a natural justice also should have a provision to appeal. Or it straight away it goes into the person is put in the jail. Or is there an appeal which is, no, I'm saying it's both. The exploitation can happen on either side. Just wanted to understand the other aspect of that. How the male employee can safeguard himself or on this kind of thing.
Well, so I don't think the police authorities are going to file an FIR unless they are confident enough that there is adequate merit in the complaint. But obviously, I think going by the principles of law, there would be an opportunity for the male employer, for the harasser, to defend his case. And based on that, it's really up to the police authorities to take it forward.
On the slide number 14, there are two pointers which are actually kind of seeing that where the misuse can happen. Is one, it says interference with work or creating an intimidating hostile environment. And second is humiliating treatment likely to affect health or safety. Now, if you look at the way the BP or the IT industry or most of the organizations work today, suppose there is a deliverable which is to be done and a person is asked to stay back late. Now, this could be treated as it is going to affect the safety of the person. Now, it is like when you say that you have to stay. Have to stay means you have kind of, you can say the whether you will have to kind of force that person to stay. Now, is it not kind of attracting this kind of a thing?
No, so these are like broad circumstances that could lead to sexual harassment. So you have to read that provision in its entirety to mean that any humiliating treatment, which in turn is likely to affect the safety of the female employee. So just by asking her to work in the night shift should not in itself be considered as a humiliating treatment. And there will need to be sort of additional acts based on which it could end up being considered as a sexual harassment. You know, at this stage, just by, you know, because there is a requirement of the work and you want her to work in night shift, should not in itself be considered as a circumstance leading to sexual harassment.
Or I'm saying asking someone to do the necessary duties, or let's say there's a goal which are set, this person is... has to abide by that. Now, it could be treated as interference with work or creating a hostile environment. Because you have to complete this task, and those tasks need to be completed. Now, it's a business call, or the goals have been set as per the HR process.
No, I agree with you. I mean, obviously, these are sort of parameters and not in itself comprising or leading to sexual harassment. But I think what the law is saying is that these kind of examples could lead to sexual harassment. I think that's what the law is trying to say. So it's trying to educate female employees that, you know, all of this could eventually lead to sexual harassment. I think that's the context in which this provision has been added.
Sure. Thanks so much, Arthur. Thanks. Wonderful session. Thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Shalini Hamir Vasya from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Hi. A quick question on the aggrieved woman. Now, of course, we've included the workplace definition and aggrieved woman to contract employees as well as own employees. But what if there is an external visitor or a candidate come for an interview into the office premises, and there is a situation of harassment, or, you know, something to the reverse, where a female employee, because of her work duties, has to travel to a client site or to a vendor partner's work premise, and there is an incident which takes place. So she is there for work, but it's beyond.
Just to respond to that, in fact, just earlier this week, we were working for a client in terms of reviewing or adopting their policy to the new law. And we also added recruitment applicants in the list of protected categories. Who can actually, if they feel that they are sexually harassed, they can actually rely on the policy. So the policy was broad enough to even cover, applicants who come to the office for interviews, you know. So just to answer your question, it's really, who the employee is and where the incident happening, which will be a critical factor. So if your employee travels to a customer location for a business purpose, he's really traveling on duty, and to that extent you may continue to be held responsible. But obviously, if it happens at the customer's workplace, then I'm assuming the customer would also have a policy in place.
Yeah, but situations like if the female employee has to use a public transport like a taxi or a train or whatever for travel, and there's an incident on the way, or like I said, you know, at a vendor partner's meeting place.
So I think if she is traveling for work, I think she would be covered within this law.
Okay. All right.
Like, I think it also envisages traveling to the airport for a sort of outpatient trip or something like that. You know, all of that seems to be included within the workplace.
Okay. Because if the harasser is a non-employee who's not in control of the employer, It could be a cab driver or the client himself or, you know, an external person.
I think that's where the Indian Penal Code provisions would come into perspective, because you obviously will not be, it will not be possible for you to, you know, do it under the ICC, because it's an external person whom you don't really know. So that's where the IPC provision would become relevant.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Priya Basu from Noble Biocare. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking us through this session. It is really you know, good for us. I have one question regarding the fourth member of the ICC. As you said, that that member should be one of the senior most members in the organization. And the member should be from an external party or NGO. Now, in terms of the definition of external party, if the member is a senior most female employee, a senior female employee from another subsidiary from another country of the same company, is it okay?
Sorry, can you just repeat it once again? I couldn't
get the context. The fourth member of the ICC, if that person, I mean, when you say external, that person should be from an external body. It can be an NGO. Can it be also subsidiary? I mean, we are an Indian subsidiary. So we have, say, subsidiary in Hong Kong as well, in Asia Pacific. So can that member, the fourth member of the committee, be a senior most employee, female employee, and is from the Hong Kong subsidiary of the same company? Is it acceptable as far as the fourth member of ICC is concerned?
You know, I would assume not, because that defeats the purpose of having someone independent within the ICC. So while the law does not actually provide that clarification, I mean, if you're going to have the fourth person from like your parent entity or from your affiliate, mm-hmm. Outside of India, I fear that it will defeat the purpose of having somebody totally independent who can bring that sort of independence within the ICC's you know, inquiry process.
Okay. So ideally, what you all are saying is to take that person from an absolutely independent body, maybe a NGO or maybe something else, right? I mean, absolutely outside of the parent company also.
Yes, basically, is that person able to bring in that level of independence, mm-hmm. would be the determining factor.
Okay, all right, thanks.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Geeta Kamath from Oracle Financial Services. Please go ahead. Ms. Kamath, your line is unmuted. Please ask a question. We shall take a next question from the line of Bhavika Dave from INFS. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. Hi, Vikram. Oh, amazing session. Thank you so much. So my question is very simple. I just want to understand. I think this is already discussed earlier, but then I am not clear on this. Say, for example, there's a holding company and there are a lot of subsidiaries company below. They sit on the same place or the same premises, share the same premises. In that case, if the subsidiary is a listed company, would the subsidiary company need to have a separate ICC, or it can have the same ICC as the holding company?
So, again, as I said, the rules don't provide clarity on these kind of arrangements. And to the extent it is possible, each employer, even if they are sharing the same workplace, each employer should form the same. Each employer should form an ICC on its own. It's only in a situation where, like say, for example, you know, a particular entity at that office does not have a senior level female employee who can act as a presiding officer. That's where you might be able to look at the sister entity or the parent entity, and you know, use its employees to form the ICC. But unfortunately, these kind of combinations or this kind of flexibility where we've been getting a lot of questions, it's not really clarified under the law. And to that extent, I think we started to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
No, but you suggest us to... sorry, thank you. You suggest just to wait in that case and look at how the law takes him?
No, I think you should go ahead and form the committee because I don't expect any further clarifications. We were hoping that it would come in the rules, but nothing's really clarified in the rules. So I think it's time that you start forming your ICC for each of your companies.
And the policy that we make should be at the group level, correct? That's fine.
Well, again, see, the policy can always be extended to each entity. So to that extent, there isn't a problem. It's only how we are going to set up the ICC.
Okay. Fine. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Rakesh Tiwari from SSP. Please go ahead.
Hi Vikram, I see that this Vishakha guideline mostly covers two aspects. One is the redress and the resolve grievances, which actually is covered in detail in the presentation, and most of the questions are actually directed towards the redress and resolving of the grievances. There's another thing which is the focus of the guideline is the prevention and prohibition of the sexual harassment. So is there any specific guidelines related to this for the prevention, like the camera or anything?
Sorry, like
setting up the cameras or within the work premise or something similar. So that I didn't find any detailed coverage of the prevention part.
Oh, okay. So Rakesh, your question is whether there are any additional requirements for the employer to comply with to prevent sexual harassment?
Right.
No, I mean, except for the fact that you need to have a policy and a procedure needs to be set up and form ICC and all, which are geared towards ensuring that employees will be aware that, you know, what is sexual harassment, what is not sexual harassment, and try and prevent it. You know, except for that, the law does not go on to prescribe any additional obligations upon the employer that, you know, you need to have cameras at sort of central locations or, you know, across the rooms and all that stuff. That's not really something that's provided under the law, and to that extent you can look at it in terms of, you know, what kind of technology you would want to incorporate within your organization to support, you know, your policy to prevent sexual harassment at the workplace.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Chandana Dhar from Monsanto India Limited. Please go ahead.
Hi Vikram, thanks for a lovely session. I have just two very short questions. You spoke about this annual return. So does it also have to be a nil annual return? As in, if there are no cases reported during a year, does the company still have to file a nil return, so to say?
Yes.
Okay. And the next one, we are speaking about frivolous complaints being filed and punishments being meted out for that. Is there any scope or provision regarding non-retaliation for the victim as well during pendency of an inquiry or an investigation? Or is it left to the company to put in its policy?
Yeah, it's not prescribed under the law in terms of a non-retaliation. If you recall, I also had a provision in our analysis that there's no provision on victimization. So that kind of safeguards have obviously not been captured under this law. So somewhere we felt that if those provisions were added, you know, it could kind of give some sort of more comfort to a female employee. You know, they would be more confident that the, you know, employer would not treat them differently if they go ahead and, you know, make a complaint.
So do I read that as for a progressive employer, if it were to add such a non-retaliation clause, that should be okay, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, we would recommend that to be added to your policy, even though the law does not require. Because what you're really wanting to do is to make it convenient, make it easy for female employees, you know, make them feel comfortable that, you know, they will be, you know, treated fairly if they do go and make a complaint. So I would encourage you to do that.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Shukla Vasan from Hindustan Coca-Cola. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. It was a great presentation. Just two requests, one query and a request. Could you send me the presentation because I don't seem to have been able to get to see that. That's one. The second thing is my query is supposedly there is a complaint by a female on sexual harassment and the matter is getting investigated. The female, when the plea of that she is not well or some pretext or the other, refuses to come on duty. and then she makes a request that she wants a transfer. And she makes a transfer of a specific unit. Supposedly, it's a multi-unit. You know, in a city of, say, Delhi, we've got two plants, and if she says, I want to go to A plant and not B, then she wants A plant. Whereas we don't have an opportunity in A plant, we want to give an opportunity in B plant. When we tell her, okay, fine, we are considering, so please come back and let us know, then she comes up with a new storyline, I am mentally harassed, I need some time. How much time does an organization need to do? And, you know, while the investigation is in progress, the final report is awaited, she also makes her coming back to the company as a precondition to knowing as to what is happening, what is the outcome to her investigation. Now, it looks as if the employee is possibly trying to hold the company at a ransom. If it is so, what should be the way out?
See, these interim reliefs that employees would end up asking while the investigation is going on is really at the discretion of the employer. I don't think an employee can, as a matter of right, say that she wants a three-month leave. In fact, the law has a provision of granting leave of up to 3 months. But for whatever reason, you know, you say that, no, that's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. As long as you create a more conducive condition within the workplace, I think that should suffice. I mean, I don't see a reason why an employee can come back and say that she wants to be transferred at a particular location. The request could be to transfer, but not to a particular location, because again, it's at your discretion where you want that person to be transferred. You know, as an employer, you obviously have a better perspective as to where this employee needs to be transferred, because, you know, where her skills would be relevant and where it would not be relevant. So all of that discretion rests upon you as an employer. And you can very well refuse those requests from the employee as long as you have some reason to it or you're already able to provide a sort of a safe and conducive working condition at your existing office.
What if she says that you're giving me plant B or office B and I don't think I'm secure there? What are you going to do to make me secure?
Well, I mean, again, she needs to come up with slightly more concrete reasons why she does not feel secured at plant B. As I said, she can't, as a matter of right, seek a transfer to a specific plant. It's really your discretion. So, you know, just by, you know, that request is not good enough for you to consider, I think that's fine. It's your discretion at the end of the day.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Sanchita Banerjee from Ernst & Young. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My question is, if the harasser and the aggrieved woman both are from different employees, is the deciding factor for as to which ICC the complaint needs to be filed to depends on the location where the harassment has happened, as to whose premise the harassment happened?
Yeah, so I mean, in a situation where the complainant.
Yeah.
I think what is critical is that who's the complainant and where is the workplace that the incident happened in determining which employer's ICC will have to take up that matter. So again, I mean, these issues are something that we now start seeing, especially where, you know, vendors, employees come and work with you or, you know, you send your employees to client locations and things like that. So I think this is something that we expect it to evolve. And obviously the law does not really clarify that. But if you look at this law, I think the critical factors are, you know, who is the complainant and, you know, where is the workplace where the incident happened.
Okay. Just in case it has happened at an external location, say at a trade meet or at some seminar, then whose responsibility is it to take care of this allegation? Where does the complainant go? To the ICC office or her own employer or to that of the harasser?
So if the complainant is at a seminar representing the employer,
yeah.
I think she'll have to complain to the ICC of that employer that this happened. But again, practically, because the employer is not going to be able to get the harasser involved in the investigation, I think
yeah.
the employer would be better off just going with accompanying the complainant to the police authorities and let it be handled under the IPC rather than under this law, because it's really a matter of someone external complaining outside the workplace, and really the employer will not be able to have any control in that kind of a situation.
Correct. So in this case, judging the compensation also will not be justified because they cannot decide the compensation for a harasser who is with another company.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be impossible for you to follow the guidelines under this law for this kind of an incident.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question from the line of Reena Jalan from Infrastructure Standard and Living. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I just had one follow-up question. Now, the places where law is not clear, whether we can have common ICC for holding and subsidiary, or it's not clear that, you know, ICC, what do you mean by different places? So is there any way out that we can, you know, apply for clarification or apply for exemption?
Well, you can always apply for clarifications. I don't know even if the Labor Department would be in a position to clarify, because they may also not be in a position to answer those kind of questions where the law is not clarified. So, yeah, you can apply, but I would say that don't really expect any definitive response. I mean, in these kind of matters, it's better not to actually apply to the Labor Department. You would rather take a sort of a view based on some justification and form the committee in good faith, hoping that, you know, you are trying to comply with the provisions of the law to the extent possible, rather than trying to, you know, go with these kind of questions to the Labor Department.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the last question. I now hand over the conference over to Mr. Vikram Shroff, Head HR Law, Nishit Desai Associates. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for staying late this evening for this important session. Feel free to write to us if you have any follow-up questions. Thanks a lot. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference call. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines. Thank you.
Thank you.